Welcome back to the program. I'm your host and producer, Betsy Rosenberg, and I'm very happy to welcome for the first time to the program our guest, Mary Ellen Hannibal. She writes often about science and the environment and biodiversity. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Scientific American, Outside, just to name a few publications. She also is the organizer of a special series starting next month for the entire month of August that will be held a series of lectures at the San Francisco Commonwealth Club, one of my favorite places, with their Climate One program. They've got lots of great speakers from all across not only the country but around the world. So I was very pleased to have her available coming in from the tide pools this morning to be on the show. I think I'd rather be out in the tide pools personally, but that certainly shows that you are on the green front lines in terms of studying nature and what it has to tell us. So thanks for taking time to be with us.
Thank you so much, Betsy.
What got you involved in this lecture program? Let's start with that, because that's coming up most immediately, and then we can sort of drill down and out, if you will, from there.
Sure. Well, it all kind of goes together. I have a book out right now called The Spine of the Continent, mm-hmm. and it will be out in paperback August 6th with a new subtitle. So the new subtitle is The Race to Save America's Last Best Wilderness. And last fall, some folks at the Commonwealth Club heard me on another radio show talking about this book and got very excited about the subject. And basically, The Spine of the Continent is about, it's a large landscape conservation initiative, which sounds like such a big formal thing, which it is. It's a political effort, a social effort, a grassroots effort to connect linked landscapes down the Rockies. And this is based on 30 years of conservation biology, which tell us that in order for nature to persist, nature has to be connected to itself. So we might have thought, and we did think, you know, when we started the national park system in the early part of the century, that putting our arms around a protected area and limiting human impacts there would save the creatures that lived within it. And it turns out not to be the case. And this is understood on a variety of different levels. But the main thing about The Spine of the Continent is that it's such an incredibly positive way forward to try to get a hold of what science calls the sixth mass extinction event, which unfortunately is going on under our noses right now. So the Commonwealth Club asked me to kind of guest produce a month of programming around saving nature. And I've got to say, we have the most amazing lineup of thinkers, and anybody lucky enough to live in the Bay Area who can come to a couple of these, you can really get kind of a whole education about the environment, what's going on, the bad news, the good news, and just kind of the sheer love of nature going on in this month.
And it does sound fabulous, Mary Ellen. And for those of us who will be traveling most of the month of August, in an environmentally friendly way, of course, and those who don't live in the Bay Area, I think the Commonwealth Club normally makes their lectures available online or via radio.
Yeah, they do. They broadcast a lot of them. And I'm not sure if every single one of them gets broadcast, but they will broadcast a lot of them, and there is access to them.
Okay. We will have time at the end of the interview to talk about some of the speakers coming up, but I want to just key off of something you just said. Are you saying that natural spaces, wild places, need to have natural symbiosis to thrive and not be siloed and protected with a line around it, so to speak?
Yes, and I basically explain this in two dimensions, although there's more dimensions to describe it. One is genetics. So, for example, there are about 600 grizzly bears in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. And there are like 30,000, almost 30,000 grizzly bears living up in the wilds of Canada. But between those two populations, there's all of these places that have no grizzly bears. So if that population of grizzly bears in Yellowstone can't mingle with others of its own kind, there'll be inbreeding depression, and that population will disappear. So one of the things the Spine of the Continent does is identify places where there's good grizzly bear habitat. There's lots of wild spaces still between Yellowstone and Canada, and an organization called Y2Y, Yellowstone to Yukon or Yukon to Yellowstone, really works hard on grizzly bear connectivity. And they try to get protections and just mechanisms put in place, not to exclude other uses of the land. Many of these places can be agricultural, they can be national forests where we can go hiking, but to figure out a way to cohabit with grizzly bears on landscapes that are important to them. Now, that's, I kind of think of as a horizontal way that connectivity is important. Animals need to move to stake new territory and to renew their populations genetically. And a creature like the wolf needs, you know, thousands of miles for restaking new territory. But another way that nature needs connectivity, I think of as vertically, and that's like on a landscape. And a great example of that is, in fact, this another Yellowstone example of the Yellowstone wolf story. So wolves were extirpated or taken off of Yellowstone entirely by 1926 or something, or 29. In the 90s, they were reintroduced. And in the meantime, between the time of the wolves getting off of Yellowstone and the 90s when they were put back on, the ecosystem started to spiral downward in Yellowstone. And nobody could do anything about it. They didn't know what was wrong. Why suddenly is the Lamar River not have any vegetation on its banks? It's getting muddy. It's getting silty. The wildlife is disappearing from the river. And the rivers and the creeks and the waterways, of course, are a lifeline and the most fundamental connectivity that we have. When the wolves were reintroduced, everything started to change. And scientists have been following this extremely closely. And what they have documented is something that they call a trophic cascade. And I like this phrase too, the ecology of fear. So what was happening at Yellowstone and other waterways, the Lamar River, is that elk, super abundant elk that had no predator, were eating the vegetation down to the ground where it could not recruit or build or grow back up. So it would take out all of the habitat for all of the creatures that usually live by a river. When the wolves came back, it's not like they kill so many elk, because a wolf at most is like 120 pounds, whereas an elk can be 900 pounds. They usually win in a fight with wolves. Hmm. But wolves change the behavior of elk. Elk, when they know that the predator is around, keep moving themselves, and they look around over their shoulder every 2 minutes. It's enough to give the vegetation space to rest and grow up. So some of it grows higher than the elk's head, and then that plant stays healthy even though it's being grazed below what's called the leader, the top of the plant. So once you bring the vegetation back, beavers come back into the landscape, and they change everything. They change the hydrology system entirely. This was a real mind-blower for me when I was researching my book, is the impact that beavers have on the waterways. And the fact that our nation and Canada were both built on the backs, so to speak, of beaver. We just extirpated every single last beaver, and that's how we made money. It was the oil of the day for hundreds of years. Mm. But once we took the beaver off the waterways, they started to degrade. So the beaver come back. And then with the beaver come back, they create more habitat for other creatures because they slow the water down, they clear the water. They actually retain water that they can release in a drought. I mean, they are unreal what they do. And then more birds come by, reptiles, amphibians. Now, all of this effect has an effect on the soil because healthy vegetation sequesters carbon in the soil. And mycorrhizal fungi grows in healthy native roots. So we need this more than ever with climate change to suck down the carbon into the ground, but also as big weather events come through, fires and floods, we need the healthy vegetation to keep the riverbanks in place. So that's this vertical connectivity. So you see, if you have a place like Yellowstone where you have wolves are allowed to live there, but then you go outside that border into Montana and wolves can be shot and killed. And I am no way saying that it's easy to live with wolves if you're a rancher, but you break up this ecological interaction, and we have superabundant deer and elk in places. Elk are actually in danger in some other places. But we really have a problem with a degraded landscape where we don't have the full complement of species doing their thing on it. And that's another really, really critical part of this connectivity concept, And the very, very good news is that when you restore nature, when you basically take off the bad thing that's going, you know, when you restore the wolves to the ecosystem or you do other things to help nature do what it does naturally, nature quite often comes back very quickly.
Absolutely. Now, you know, nature is brilliant. You know, our bodies, you know, all organisms, living things, you know, whoever put this here, you know, really had it together to make an understanding of the century.
It's so fascinating. It's endlessly fascinating how it works.
It is. And yet most Americans are, for some reason, are not so fascinated, maybe because they don't know what they don't know. Our eco-literacy level is pathetically low in this country overall, you know, with all kinds of reasons for it. But how do we balance, you know, the thirst for development, growth, progress, the American way, if you will, and, you know, the problem of interfering with Mother Nature and the ecosystem, the web of life, that once you pull on one end, you know, it kind of unravels other things that may not even be apparent, you know, to the naked eye or right away.
Well, it is the most critical question. And when I was writing the Spine of the Continent, one of the things that I was so inspired by was how regular people are involved doing the right thing in their communities and in their sort of larger communities to restore nature or to, you know, work on behalf of a species. I met this fantastic woman, Sherry Tippy, who is a hairdresser. Her day job is cutting hair in the Aurora Men's County Jailhouse. Mm. But she has relocated beavers for almost 30 years. And I met just Mary O'Brien, another beaver booster, an incredible woman who works in the forests of Utah. I met Chris Ray, who's a scientist who has worked for almost 25 years in studying pica, those little rabbit relatives.
Oh, yeah.
They're so cute.
Let's talk about the plight of the pica for a minute, because I had a producer about 7 years ago. I've been doing environmental radio interviews for about 15 years now, and she was so concerned about the pica that I learned all about its, you know, ever northward creep because of climate change.
Yeah, I mean, pica is kind of the poster animal for climate change because, as your friend notes, they live at the very top of mountains in what's called talus, which are these big sort of slabby rocks, and they create their little hay piles in those rocks. They live in those during the winter, but they are not thermoregulating, so they have a very, very thick fur coat that keeps them warm in the winter, but in the summer it's very hot for them, and they can die if they are out in the noonday sun, so to speak. They hide in the talus during the hot part of the day. So the thing is that as the climate is warming, a lot of plants and animals will move upslope and are already moving. Those distributions are already shifting to kind of find a cooler little climate envelope that's comfortable for them. But pika have nowhere to go. They're already at the top. So Chris Ray, actually, I love the chapter. I spent time out in Montana in the Highlight Canyon with her. And, you know, she studied these creatures for a long time, and they are so finely attuned to microclimate that she's holding out hope that they will actually figure out a way to find a microclimate that suits them. But the news is not good for them. I mean, it's a sad tale probably for pika. And people like to say that pika are the canary in the coal mine, using that phrase that refers to the birds that were put, you know, that would die when there wasn't enough oxygen in mine shafts for the miners, and the miners would leave that mine. Mm-hmm. But the thing with the pika is when they start expiring because of climate change, we won't be able to leave. Where will we go? There's no mine shaft for us to escape. It will
It's polar bears, penguins, pikas, and people in danger.
Yeah, there you go. It's exactly. It really is.
Oh man.
But the thing about these people, Betsy, is that there's something called citizen science. It's what I'm working on my next book for, and some of the programs at the Commonwealth Club are about citizen science projects. And when people, and this is what I was doing out in the tide pools this morning, actually, down in Half Moon Bay. I was on a citizen science project. We're counting nudibranchs out there. Nudibranchs are these little psychedelic sea slugs. I mean, they're just crazy looking.
And psychedelic sea slugs, and you don't even have to be high to see them, right?
You can't even, if you were high and you looked at them, I think it would blow your mind. They are just bizarre. So citizen science, though, I think, like, it just makes people, these are volunteer projects where you help a scientific question about something that usually a scientist or maybe a municipal agency, you know, here in Marin, the Marin Municipal Water District has a citizen science project, which is documenting all of the plants on Mount Tam. There's proliferating citizen science projects all around the country. And not only does the information that regular people collect really help scientists, but being out there is the key. I mean, it's, first of all, it's just so great to be outside, and none of us get outside enough. And then when you start training your attention on things like nudibranchs, you start to really, your heart and mind start to open up to the incredible complexity of nature and its beauty and its mysteries. And then I really believe you become impassioned to help save it. And the other great thing is,
we don't save what we don't know, what we don't love. Exactly. But how do we get, finish that thought and then address how we get more Americans to, you know, participate, to get on the bandwagon, to preserve.
Yeah, it's exactly what you're saying. Well, I think that citizen science will be a way forward. The national parks are very much sponsoring a lot of citizen science projects. But, you know, here in the Bay Area, there's a ton of citizen science projects, and big cities tend to have them. But I would recommend people finding them in their areas. And then this has even a bigger, I think, implication. Back to your question about how do we balance the needs for development, the needs to get along with sometimes, you know, wildlife can be hard to live with. And I think it is about communities making decisions about what's important to them. And sometimes those trade-offs will be, well, we do need to build a new shopping mall here because we do need the commerce for our area. But citizen science and education about where we live can help choose a better place to locate that, like not in a wildlife corridor, not where animals and plants really use that area to move. And scientists are out there analyzing where are the important wildlife corridors. A lot of western states have corridor maps, connectivity things. You can, Arizona does, for example, you can look at their HABA map online. Here in the Bay Area, you can go online to the Bay Area Open Space Council, and you can look at their critical habitat, their linkages maps. And this will be more and more what we do, I think, really analyze the value of the land, not only to us in our immediate needs, but to nature, because we need nature to be healthy, to sustain our own life. And that's something we really need to understand, that helping nature helps us.
Indeed. Now, I want to give you time to highlight a couple of the speakers, and we just have a few minutes left. But very quickly, I can't let you go without asking you what you mean when you say conservation is something we do door to door.
Well, here's the thing, like, about connectivity, for example. I've been following in Sonoma County, north of here, efforts by I think it's Sonoma Land Trust, to protect a very important corridor where animals have been moving. And they track these animals with cameras and with regular people observing them, and then, of course, wildlife professionals out there kind of knowing where the animals are moving. But people live on those lands, and they don't always know that cougars go through their backyard. So the folks at the Sonoma Land Trust have to go around door to door and say, do you know that you live in a habitat corridor? And, you know, sometimes someone will say, no, I'm sure we don't. There has not been a cougar seen here for the last 50 years. And then they show photographs, and they say, well, look at this. This looks like your property, and it sure looks like a mountain lion. And it's really, once people know that they are intimately involved with wildlife without they hadn't even known it, then they suddenly become very interested in protecting it and in cooperating.
And I
so they
be,
have to
I mean,
be educated about it.
Exactly. Here for more education, raising our eco-literacy. In the minute or two we have left, just give us some of the speakers that will be coming up for the August series that you've organized.
Well, I was listening to your previous broadcast about this issue with Google, and here's some good news about Google. On Tuesday, August 6th, Google Earth Outreach will be featured along with something called iNaturalist. Google Earth is actually empowering tribal peoples in South America and Africa with smartphone technology to report in real time when people are illegally harvesting their forests and other things going on. So this program on that night, which is at 6 p.m., is about smartphone technology in the hands of everybody. You and I can use it to help biodiversity, and so can these tribal people. That's a really great one. Another one on a kind of a little bit more of a dire note is on Monday, August 19th, and that's Professor Anthony Barnosky from UC Berkeley. He's a paleoecologist, and he'll be talking about Earth is reaching a tipping point in the way that it operates because of human impacts. And he'll be talking about what those are and how we can scale those back.
Mary Ellen, we're at a tipping point as far as the clock goes, I'm afraid.
Okay.
But if you go to the Commonwealth Club website, I'm sure you can see the schedule for August. I want to thank you for all your great work, for organizing this special speaker series, for taking time out to be with us today. I feel better, just like I said to my first guest and second today's show, knowing you're out there doing this work. And people like you should be on CNN, you know, on a regular basis. You know, we need to get the ecologists out there who can really connect the green dots for more Americans, and that's what we try to do with the show. So you're one of the bright spots. I really want to appreciate your work, and thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
And if you're joining us mid-interview or mid-show, you can go to the archives at the Progressive Radio Network website or our website at thegreenfront.com. That does it for today's edition. I will be traveling next week, so I'll be playing the best of Betsy's. I'll find one of my favorite shows from the last few months, and they'll play that in the PRN studio for you. In the meantime, I want to wish you a safe and green week or two ahead.
We just come together.